The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. From the unusual to the extraordinary, your website stands out when you build it with Squarespace. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
Football Weekly on another remarkable week in football. Today, one for sorrow, two for joy, but Newcastle put six Magpie goals past Norwich for their first win of the season. So, Tim Krul was the problem all along. We've got words on that and all the rest of the Premier League weekend. Man United at Everton, Hammers at the Palace, and then we look at the big midweek Champions League fixtures. The Germans, they're good at Bayern World Cups, but what about Bayern Arsenal? That's the question. We'll look at PSG Real and so much more from those Tuesday and Wednesday games. Plus, Leeds. Turns out we weren't the only ones Brighton caused a career setback to, as Uwe Rosler gets the chop. We check out the Euro 2016 playoffs here from Dr. Sid and more in this Football Weekly. Hello, friends. Here we are, ready for another week in the wide and crazy world of football. And can I just say, Amy days and Mondays always get me not down. We've got Amy Lawrence in.
Hello, James.
Hi, Amy.
How are you?
I'm very well, actually. I'm very well. How could I not be with so much to talk about in this week's exciting Football Weekly? And you're here to do it, which is, you know, double plus good. And Greg Bukowski as well. Fantastic.
Hi, James.
Oh, you know what this lineup needs? It needs a Barry.
Hello.
And it's got one. All right, listeners. Hey, Champions League. We're also going to talk about Ireland drawing Bosnia-Herzegovina in those Euro 2016. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, but I think only one team can lead things off, and that's Steve McClaren's high-flying Magpies. Wow, who followed this one?
I saw a strange, skittish performance from Newcastle in which they were brilliant, and then they looked so brittle. They go from brilliant to brittle very quickly when they concede a goal. And then they were brittle for quite a while, and Norwich looked like they might come back into the game in the second half and were actually on top when it was 3-2 to Newcastle. And he thought, oh, Norwich are going to get the equaliser here. It's all going to go wrong for Steve McClaren again. And then they counter-attacked and scored, and it was almost like Newcastle had to be the underdogs before they could start playing again. I do think that's one of the issues he's got there, and in that there's maybe a mentality thing where they need to believe in themselves a bit more, and when things are expected of them, you know, actually just play. Play.
So there was a fine line between success and failure in this game.
It was like their season kind of in one game at the point. I know it was 6-2 in the end, but up to 62 minutes it looked like it was going to be 3-3 to with Norwich.
Right. But it was six goals against the Norwich side that are incredibly tight and incredibly good on the road.
They have been. And, you know, you look at Newcastle's forward line, they've got some very creative players. They've got players who, in fact, you wouldn't maybe be out of place in, you know, top five, top six teams. Sissoko was really creative. Mm. He was a driving force in everything they did. Obviously, Wijnaldum gets the headlines.
Was he used in a different way, Sissoko?
I saw him cutting in from... He was on the right-hand side. He was cutting in. He was running in the channels. I mean, Norwich didn't... They have been tight. They didn't defend well in this game, which is an understatement when you concede his six goals. I just thought the movement of Newcastle's forward players was really good. Steve McCann would be very happy with that. And, you know, I think he in himself deserves a bit of credit for, throughout the bad run they've had this season, he hasn't worn the look of someone who's felt sorry for himself and has just got on with it. And, you know, he's not really whinged. And I do think the results could turn around for them now, although they have got the Tyne-Wear Derby coming up next, which is
Tyne-Wear Derby
huge
against a Sunderland side that's fresh from a 1-0 defeat at the hands of West Brom, Barry. Could you give us a line on that?
Well, they were robbed by the referee, according to Sam Allardyce. They never, ever looked like conceding a goal, apart from the goal they conceded. But it shouldn't have been allowed, to be fair. He did have a point. There were two infringements. Saido Berahino jumped into Kostel Pantilimon, but I still thought it was a very weak effort goalkeeping, considering the difference in their sizes.
I'm not sure that matters if somebody barrels into your stomach.
Well, he should have come for the ball and made sure he either caught it or punched it clear. But anyway, you know, he was fouled in the air, and then he got his hands on the ball on the ground, and Berahino kicked the ball out of his hands and into the, eventually into the net. So, yeah, you know, it was unfortunate, but there were reasons for optimism for Sunderland insofar as they were quite stout defensively. But again, West Brom offered very little going forward. They're a remarkably dull and defensive team.
Want to get back to Wijnaldum. Mm. Ooh, Amy.
Well, I was just going to say, I think there's an interesting sort of psychological effect on what's going to go into next week's preparations. I mean, I think it's inevitable that Sunderland might find themselves a bit too caught up with the Big Sam-ism of this particular...
You wanted to say narrative, didn't you?
Not really.
Oh, okay. My mistake.
but also the kind of psychological impact for Newcastle, that just their body language. And I mean, having been sort of stodgy and plodding along and struggling for so long, that feeling of unshackling that you could see in the players, in the manager. I mean, a guy like Mitrovic, for example, who scored a cracking goal. You just wonder whether that's what they need to allow them to feel that they can express themselves a bit more, which is why, going into the next game, if they don't get too, the whole Samism doesn't become too much of a thing,
yeah,
if they can actually get something from that game, I think that they will really have turned a corner.
Well, we'll talk more about the derby on Thursday, but I just want to say, saw the Chelsea game that they had. They didn't look at all stodgy there. They looked very unfettered in that one. Of course, it didn't work out for them. But again, there was that feeling of a team that had cast off its mental shackles in the way that Howard Jones urged us to do all those years ago, of course. Very much on the playlist, perhaps, at St James's Park. Greg. Wijnaldum. Did you know that no one scored four goals for Newcastle in a game since Alan Shearer?
And there
Wijnaldum
he is.
Did.
And he's a player who, it's a surprise that he's at Newcastle in the first place. He's a, you know, he was the player of the year in the Eredivisie last season. He was captain of PSV, who won the league, and he scored 18 goals as an attacking midfielder. And it's a coup that, you know, Newcastle have got him. Perhaps that shows the power of the Premier League pound these days, that you can attract players from title-winning sides to, you know, play a side that has struggled to get going this season. But he scored in his first game for Newcastle, and since then he is flattered to deceive a bit. But he's been playing in a team that has been so up and down. And I say up, the ups have just been 0-0 draws against you know, better sides than them. But now, you know, he scored these goals, and there was a bit of a great understanding, actually, with Sissoko. Perez as well looked like he linked up well with him. And Amy mentioned Mitrovic there, who I think is going to be a really good player for Newcastle over the next couple of seasons, because he's very young, but he's strong. His attitude's great. He doesn't think twice, you know, before he shoots as well, so, which is what they need. Although the defence is still a bit of a worry for Newcastle.
Well, twas ever thus, eh?
I think they need to be consistent, Newcastle. That's the key. I think under Pardew, they were one of the streakiest teams. They'd win 13 games or, you know, some ridiculous run, be knocking on the door of the Champions League, then they'd lose the next 13 or something, you know. Maybe not quite that ridiculous. I think McLaren's just got to find some consistency there.
All right, well, this was a good start in that direction anyway. Newcastle moving off the bottom of the pile with their victory. City are still at the top. Then you've got Arsenal and United. And, oh my word, West Ham still there in the top four, Barry. After their latest away success. You were there, I believe, at Selhurst Park.
I was, yeah. It was an interesting game. Very lively first half. West Ham went ahead through Carl Jenkinson. It's his second goal in as many games from right back. And then he, almost immediately from the kickoff, he gave away a penalty, clattered into Dwight Gale, and Gale encroached on the penalty, and it had to be retaken by Yohan Cabaye, and he rifled it into the top corner. But it was, the match sort of hinged on Dwight Gale, who he was playing up front for Palace, and he had a very strange game. He was playing well, but constantly moaning at the ref. He was getting in needless tussles with opposition players off the ball. He encroached on that penalty, and then he got booked for a bad tackle. I think it was after 30 minutes, and you just knew that was it. He was going to get a red, you know, get a second yellow, and it duly arrived on 44 minutes for another bad tackle. And Alan Pardew thought Mark Clattenburg should have been perhaps a bit more lenient, but I thought it was a fair enough booking. And if he hadn't got sent off for that, he almost certainly would have got sent off for something else.
Right. What did you make of West Ham, anyway?
I thought they were really impressive. I mean, they did have to huff and puff a bit all throughout the second half because Palace were just sitting back trying to keep protect their point. And they had four strikers on the bench, a very high-quality substitutes bench, and three of them were involved in the sort of, not the winning goal, but the second goal. Mm. Zarate crossed for big Andy Carroll, who did his usual, headed across the face of goal. Jelovic tried to scramble it in, but couldn't, and Lanzini mm-hmm. popped up and just rifled it in. And then Crystal Palace set off, and, you know, frantically trying to get an equaliser, and then a brilliant pass from Lanzini to Paye, who was excellent throughout, and he scored with a lovely little chip. Right. But yeah, I was very impressed with West Ham. And afterwards, Slaven Bilic said it was probably the best of their away performances.
Right. He looked very emotional afterwards in that interview. I saw it, and I was watching it, you know, at home. I was a bit hungover, and it looked like Bilic's...
Why were you hungover, Greg?
I was best man at a wedding on Saturday.
Cool. Do you want to give your best wishes to the happy couple?
Yeah, although they're in Mexico now, I'm afraid. Right. Well, you might be listening. Hey, yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, you know.
All right, you know
good,
who you
good
are.
On you, Charlotte and Dave.
Did you give a speech and stuff?
I gave a speech, yeah.
What was your killer line, Greg?
Something to do with a mobility car that my... you know, the groom used to drive around. Used to drive a mobility car to play five-a-side football. So, as you can imagine, that went down well with the in-laws. It was a good old day.
Excellent. Anyway, so there you were in a tired and emotional state yourself, and Slaven Bilic.
Yeah, and his voice cracked with emotion at one point when he was saying how proud he was of his players for this win at Crystal Palace. And
perhaps he had a sore throat.
I don't think he did. I'm sure he was. Tears were close to his eyes, and I just thought, like, if this is how emotionally he gets over this win against Crystal Palace, if they do, you know, keep this kind of form up and to get in the Champions League or something, I do worry for him. He's so emotional.
Do you think that's likely, Greg?
No, okay, maybe right. not.
But afterwards, in the press conference he gave to the newspaper guys, I was sitting in the front row in the middle, and someone asked him a question. I think it was just to explain, you know, their good away form. And he went off on this very impassioned explanation about it. I think he says we're more patient away from home and sometimes at home, but he went on for about 3 minutes, and he just staring at me the whole time, right into my eyes, probing my soul. I was actually starting to feel pretty uncomfortable. I'm not sure. I think it was just because I happened to be sitting right in front of him rather than he was drawn to my animal magnetism.
Maybe he listens to the pod, Barry, because wasn't it on our last show that you were saying he looked like he was an ill man? You were worrying that he was going to keel over or something.
But I just thought he looked a bit poorly, that's all. I didn't think, you know, he was going to die.
Right. Well, perhaps he'd identified you as a fellow smoker and thought, I could do with a tab.
Maybe.
He might have one. But he never quite plucked up the nerve to ask. Anyway, terrific result there for West Ham, who, as we mentioned, stay in the top four in those Champions League positions. Speaking of the Champions League, Arsenal, Amy.
Yes, James.
Big week for the Gunners. And you got the perfect preparation, in Arsene Wenger's own words, by beating Watford 3-0.
Yeah, I think they're so strange, Arsenal, because the more you look at it, in comparison to recent form, those European games are so much of a strange, inexplicable blip. Actually, over the past, you know, the Manchester United performance and the Watford performance, the Leicester performance away from home prior to that, they're really in a groove. They've found their attacking rhythm, defensively looking quite solid. They've got the elusive balance, which is what Arsenal can't do in the Champions League so easily, between going for it and showing off their attacking wares and being careful at the back. That's the balance that has completely let them down in a lot of Champions League games. And I think they sort of get very stuck between, we really, really need to win this, and, you know, we know we've got to be cautious in the Champions League because it's tricky. And actually, it was interesting, Arsene Wenger, after the Watford game, pretty much alluding to that, saying we've got to decide how we're going to play against Bayern, which is quite an interesting remark to have a couple of days before the game. But there is this sense of, you know, he said 0-0 wasn't enough against Bayern, where actually I think possibly 0-0 would be a very decent result.
But and just you've lost your first two games, Amy.
Yes.
You're really on the brink of crashing out of the tournament, not reaching the playoffs for the knockout stages for the first time in 12 seasons.
Yes, but I still think there's a possibility that if they can redress the balance against Olympiacos and Zagreb in the last two matches, that even getting a point or two against Bayern might be enough. A lot of that depends on how Olympiacos and Zagreb do against each other. If for Arsenal's dream scenario would be for them to draw against each other twice and only manage...
So not a must-win game, but, this?
Well, I mean, I can see the perception that it should be a must-win game, but I don't think Arsenal ought to be disappointed if they draw. Yeah, but Arsenal have actually picked up wins
in what
Bayern.
Circumstances?
I know
in what
strange circumstances, but...
The circumstances...
It's better to have had to be able to go on a trip like that and think, OK, we've got experience of winning this game twice in the last couple of seasons, rather than we've got experience of going there and getting
Bayern
smashed.
Have experience of winning at the Emirates twice in the past three
that
seasons.
That is indeed true.
Do you think they can do a West Ham and win again at the Emirates, do you think? Do an Aston Villa?
I think Bayern Munich could do anything they want to do
if they're in
that mood.
Yeah.
But they did only win 1-0, which by their standards of the season is surely they must be a bit panicky.
Say you're Arsene Wenger, how are you going to set Arsenal up to play against Bayern Munich? Are you going to go out defensively or are you going to go at them? Because I imagine you've got to go at them just because I can't see them not scoring, even if Arsenal try to sit in and
But if Arsenal had that sense of, look, we've got lots of different ways we can play in the Champions League, we know how to have a sort of a cautious game. We know how to go for it and try and blitz someone as they did Manchester United in the recent Premier League game, for example. Okay, but that's not Arsenal's recent experience of Champions League matches. Arsenal's recent experience of Champions League matches, particularly at home, and you can include Monaco and Anderlecht from last season, where they got lost and stuck and blew up in this mix between we love going forward and yet we've got to be a bit careful at the back. Getting that all wrong, if they get that wrong against Bayern, then it could be an incredibly nightmarish scenario.
Just a 1-0 win for Bayern this weekend, but that does make it now 9 wins from 9 for them in the Bundesliga. And indeed, since they lost the Super Cup, the German Super Cup on penalties at the start of August, they've won every single match they've played. The two teams that Arsenal lost to in the Champions League, Bayern have beaten both, conceding no goals in the process. They do have one or two injury worries. Gertz is out, Vidal, Benatia, Ribery and Robbins in doubt. But they do have Thomas Müller and that Lewandowski fellow.
Yeah, so presumably it's going to be David Ospina in goal.
One would think.
I think Petr Cech will be back for this one.
Amy, there's no question Arsenal can pull out big performances, not just in the Premier League, in the Champions League in the past. I remember when Barcelona turned up, and to be fair, Arsenal were very harshly done by when Van Persie went off after the yellow over the goal that he'd scored after the whistle had blown and all that nonsense. They can look great. I mean, there's a chance. You've got an amazing cast of characters. And maybe Bayern will do what Wenger kind of says his players did and just not take this game seriously enough.
It's conceivable. I'd be surprised if Guardiola sends Bayern out with a complacent attitude or allows them to have that attitude. But I think Arsenal, if they are looking for inspiration, will go back quite a long time, admittedly, but to 2004, when they had only a point from their first three matches in the Champions League.
Oh, what happened?
And they'd been absolutely hammered by Inter Milan, 3-0 at Highbury. Yeah. Went to Inter in the sort of second half of the three games, and won 5-1 and actually ended up topping the group from a position of having only a point after three matches. So there's a sort of precedent of miraculous escapes. I'm not convinced it's going to happen this time, but you can see that Arsenal might try and use that as an incentive.
Yeah, I think the substantial differences between that Inter side and this Bayern Munich team. Listen, one other thing before we play a little bit of music and clear our palates. Arsene Wenger's appearance at an emotional annual general meeting last week, which featured angry shareholders rushing the stage to complain of poor European results, but also some felt hints from the great man himself that we might be entering the end game of the Wenger years.
I know some interpreted it like that. That wasn't quite how I saw it at the time. I mean, he just spoke about what he might do in terms of a legacy. He didn't say, well, I've got another 2 years of my contract and after that I want to hand over to the next man. But it's something he's said before. He's spoken quite passionately about the fact that when he does eventually call it a day, he wants to leave the man who takes over in a better position in a way than he has been.
Right. I imagine that he would like to personally select or have a major hand in saying who that next man's going to be, no?
Well, that's a complicated one.
He kind of
but
makes the decisions.
If he doesn't do that,
yeah,
and you look at the Arsenal board with dear old Sir Chips and Lord Harris of Peckham and various other gentlemen of a certain type, and wonder whether they might be best placed to make that choice. Or indeed, Stan Kroenke, who comes over to visit from America, collects his £3 million for services rendered, and I'm not convinced that he has that insight into who might be the
right
potential.
But
next
if it was, have you ever had the sense that Wenger's got his own successor already in his mind, somebody he'd like to?
No,
my
personal philosophy, based on nothing in particular, is that Arsenal will want Thierry Henry to take over.
The great communicator himself.
I mean, he's back at the club.
Amy's thigh there and he's surprised.
I was just saying, basically, it's on absolutely nothing other than just a feeling, intuition.
And what do you feel when you feel that feeling? Do you get shivers down your spine of excitement or of dread?
I think that it's based on probably at least 2 years more down the line, by which time people will have a better idea of where Henry is in terms of his coaching. I think Arsenal feel that he is such an important status symbol and that he represents something about the club. Mm. He's doing his coaching badges at the moment, working with the under-19s, and he's at the club, at the training ground, pretty much every day.
How are they doing, the under-19s?
Not bad.
Right.
They feel that he's such an important figure, and if when he does his badges, he has the passion, he has the communication skills to put into practice all his ideas about football, that they might hope he might be able to come through the system from within, as a Guardiola did, rather than necessarily having to go for somebody external.
Wow.
But then again, that might just be complete rubbish.
It's interesting theory.
Yeah. Big call, Amy. Gotta respect that.
Sure, it'll come back to bite me on the bum.
I'm Sandy Waugh. You can join me, Andy Zaltzman, and a panel of experts as we look back on all the weekend's oval ball-shaped quarterfinal action in the latest edition of our Rugby World Cup 2015 podcast. Available now on iTunes and theguardian.com.
Now, in other world of sports news, miserable day for Everton on Saturday, which began, of course, with the news that legendary manager Howard Kendall had died at the age of 69. And then came the game against Man United and a 3-0 defeat, which saw Everton doing precisely none of the things for which they've been celebrated in recent weeks. Was this emotional impact or something of the mood at Goodison? No. Was it what Van Gaal did with his Man United side that seemed to work so very well?
Yeah, I think Martinez didn't use, you know, the news about Kendall as an excuse afterwards. He just said, my team just didn't do what I wanted them to, what they have done this season so far. And I do think Van Gaal deserves credit for, you know, a bit of tactical tinkering.
What was his master stroke?
Well, he put Marshall on the left-hand side and he caused Seamus Coleman a lot of problems, and Everton couldn't build things from the back in the way they normally do. They often get the ball out to Coleman, he comes forward with it, you know, be getting to midfield quite easily. He also played Herrera further forward in the number 10 role, closer to Rooney, and he kind of was doing these Frank Lampard-esque timed runs into the box and finding space, and for his header, this run couldn't have been more perfectly timed. And I think Van Gaal, he had a more physical defence as well, which handled, you know, made United more able to handle Lukaku's physical presence.
Jones and Smalling.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that goes against what he said in the past in terms of having a player at the back who is more natural on the ball, which is why he had Danny Blind there.
Right.
Daley Blind, sorry, not Danny Blind.
Yep.
That would have been a very slow presence.
Would have been a surprise. And Wayne Rooney got a goal as well.
Yeah, and Wayne Rooney got a goal, worked his socks off, deserved it. And it was a nice finish too.
All right. Man United, are they away in the Champions League? They're at Cesca, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Of course, Cesca are unbeaten at the top of the Russian league. And that fella Dumbia, who proved so deadly for Man City last year, is in amazing form. 9 goals in 9.
Do you want another Seska stat?
I want as many as you got.
I will strafe you with the Seska stat gun. Igor Akinfev.
Wow, that's going in someone's fan fiction.
Their Igor Akinfev, their goalkeeper, has not kept a clean sheet in the Champions League for a run of 33 games, going back almost 10 years.
Really? Yes. There's some injury doubts over him, I believe.
Ah, well, then they'll keep a clean sheet.
Well, but who knows? Who knows? Over in Chelsea's group, not quite so evenly balanced because you've got Porto and Dinamo Kiev on 4 points. Chelsea on only 3. And Maccabi Tel Aviv, of course, bringing up the rear. But anyway, very exciting because Chelsea are this week away at Dinamo Kiev, or Sergei Rebrov's Dinamo Kiev, to give them their full title. But Jose Mourinho's side fresh from an exciting 2-0 win, Amy, at Stamford Bridge over Aston Villa. Now, the big news here, every week there's big news about Mourinho dropping some star player. It was Eden Hazard's turn. But he didn't just drop him or say he rested him. He actually came out and said, I will continue leaving Hazard out, or he comes in our direction and tries to play that way, saying he's got to work harder. Basically, he's just rehashed his old quotes about Wan-Mata here. Is that right?
It was a strange one, that, because, I mean, not only did he drop him, I think there's such a lot been analysed about how Mourinho is not just dropping players, but sometimes bringing them back in. Obviously, Matic coming in, he got subbed again the other day. He came on at half-time. This game against Villa, and Hazard came on for the last 10 minutes. And at the time when he came on, it was slightly awkward. I thought, watching it, I sort of felt slightly uncomfortable, as if you can tell sometimes players don't actually particularly want to come on as a sub. Either if a game is getting so badly beaten, you're 4-0 down, and they say, oh, do you want to come on now, to someone that's like, well, thanks very much, boss, what am I going to do here? Or if the game is quite comfortably won, as it was, there wasn't going to be much going on in the last 10 minutes. You could just see that it was almost a bit demeaning to just bring him on for a bit. It's almost a bit like, why bother at all? But he did send quite a strong signal afterwards in his comments. Mm. What was interesting is that Pedro actually didn't have a particularly effective game, not a great impact, playing more or less instead of Hazard. And yet he very much praised the way that what he gives is a kind of defensive solidity that the implication was that Hazard doesn't give when he's not weaving his merry tricks up front. So it didn't quite add up. But
he got a 2-0 win.
It was a very comfortable win. And Mourinho, I think, quite rightly said afterwards, there are times when you don't go from being more or less in crisis to being fantastic in one match. You sort of need that stepping stone of rediscovering
playing Aston Villa,
your solidity.
Well, yeah, Villa couldn't have done more to hand that 2-0 win to Chelsea.
So that's the thing. Was it Mou rewarded for his brilliant management of the team, or was it just, as you say, Villa completely?
No, for half an hour, in fact, it was a very mediocre match, and Villa had a couple of opportunities where they could have opened the scoring, and they were just beginning to get a bit of confidence when Brad Guzan sort of played an ill-conceived pass for Lescott, and once the ball rolled under his foot, it was just a nightmare for Villa, and all Tim Sherwood's best tactical plans sort of fell apart at that point. So
he's tried to build a house without the foundations, Tim Sherwood at Villa. He's trying to build
a villa without foundations.
It seems that way to me that he's got all these players who he wants to play the ball out from the back, and he brought Amavi in. He had Kieran Richardson at left back, and there was a time he ran back to try and gain possession off Fabregas. The ball was there. He ran past Fabregas and then turned and faced him when he just could have taken the ball earlier. And there's just so many players who look ill-suited to, you know, giving the team the defensive solidity they need when they're in a poor situation.
He's not interested in defensive solidity. No. He said that afterwards. Yeah. He said, I'm going to play
pragmatic
on the front foot, and I will die on my sword. That's how we're going to
come out swinging. Speaking of managers looking emotional after, Tim looks, and it is quite painful to see because it can't be much fun. He might be put out of his suffering quite soon because David Moyes losing again this weekend there at Real Sociedad. And we'll ask Sid when he turns up, if he turns up, in a little bit. Just on the subject, meanwhile, of Aston Villa, they were very much second best in that. This from producer Ben. Aston Villa very much second best in that game against Chelsea. We'll be at our best when we visit the second city on Thursday the 12th of November. Yeah. Birmingham Football Weekly Live is coming to you. Barry, you're involved in this.
Oh.
Ian McIntosh, also John Ashton as well, will be at the Rep Theatre to talk about Tim Sherwood, the Blues and the regeneration of New Street Station. For more details and get your tickets, go to theguardian.com/guardian live.
What, it's Amy, my what? Kind of town.
Yep. What?
No, I'm just
okay.
Smiling at the idea.
You're smirking.
Of your... No, I was you
the idea, I think Brighton it was the, to its very foundations last Friday.
So
we had Brighton Rock, in fact. I tell you what, we haven't talked about, well, lots of things, but up next in Champions League terms, Man City, who are hosting Sevilla. Man City fresh from a 5-1 win over Bournemouth. That's 11 goals scored in their last two Premier League matches, Man City.
Could have been more, too.
Yeah.
Raheem Sterling, as much as he scored a hat-trick, he had other chances he could have scored as well.
Wow. Mm. What a game for it. Was this his consecration in a City shirt?
It seemed that way. Yeah. Yeah, there was a big love in afterwards. And, I mean, I think he's a fantastic player, Raheem Sterling. His movement's fantastic, his strength as well. And they were very Raheem. One of his goals was a particular Raheem Sterling goal that he scored a spit of about 18 months ago for Liverpool against Manchester City.
Oh,
when
yeah.
he kind of danced across the penalty area and took his time and then finished. But that was also an indication of why Raheem Sterling doesn't score as many goals as he sometimes could, in that sometimes he dances a little bit too much before, you know, putting his foot through the ball and scoring.
Poor old Bournemouth. But let's hear about Man City's next opponent, Sevilla, fresh on 1-1 draw with Eibar, sitting in mid-table in the Liga. Sid Lowe, going to talk to us about that and more.
Buenos dias, Jimbo. How are you?
Oh, he says it so well. I'm very well, Sid.
You're good?
Yeah. Lots to talk to you about. We're just talking about Man City against Sevilla, who had a rotten start to the season. What kind of form are they in as they head into this clash at the Etihad?
Well, the temptation would be to look back at the last game before the international break and see them beat Barcelona and think that things are okay, but they're really not. They responded then, and there was a real sense that could be the turning point for them, because emotionally they didn't seem quite right. They weren't as aggressive as they've been in previous seasons. There wasn't the same kind of energy and dynamism about them. It was like they hadn't yet fully worked out how they wanted to play. And that win, you kind of felt that, okay, this will be the start. And then they went to Eibar this weekend and got a 1-1 draw and probably didn't deserve a huge amount more either, although it is true that Unai Emery was going a little bit bonkers, because he reckoned they had four good penalty shouts. I think he might be right on maybe two of them.
Right. Well, they're level on points with City, they're not. 3 points behind Juve on six. Juve taking on Mönchengladbach.
Yeah, I mean, their first game was obviously a game all about penalties. And they haven't played as well yet as they would have expected.
Sid, that's fantastic. In other exciting Champions League news, you've got Barcelona travelling all the way to Baty Borisov in Minsk. Minsk, yeah.
They're the original Tractor Boys, aren't they?
I believe they are, yeah.
Yeah.
The Baty Tractor Factory. Their most recent visit, or if I think they're any ever... clash with Baty before. I saw them win 4-0 and 5-0 in the two legs in the Champions League back in 2011. Barcelona, in exciting form against Rayo Vallecano?
Rayo Vallecano, yeah.
There you go, okay. 5-2 Saturday evening. And that could have been a bundle of goals for both sides, that game.
Yeah, it could. And it's created a huge debate, as always happens whenever Rayo go to Barcelona in Spain, because their manager basically wants his team to really attack people and to be very open. And against Barcelona, that's often seen as suicidal. But you get this kind of curious, almost an ideological war in Spain about it, about whether or not he's a hero for trying to do it like that or an absolute idiot for trying to do it like that. I think particularly on this particular performance, I'd say actually Rayo were pretty unfortunate. For about 25 minutes in the second half, they were easily the better side. You look at the statistics from the game, and I know the only statistics, to use the old cliche, that really matters is the final score. They had more of the ball than Barcelona, more shots than Barcelona, more corners than Barcelona, created a lot of good chances, and then got caught out and got beaten. Their aggregate score, I did have it written down here, I can't see it off the top of my head. Their aggregate score in the last 10 games between Rayo Vallecano and Barcelona is 45-3 to Barcelona.
Wow. 45 what?
45-3.
Wow.
I'm not sure if that can be right, though, because
They got two this weekend,
and I think they've scored more than that before. Hang on, I can tell you their league results, because I was actually making
a note of this. Don't worry,
well, look,
don't worry.
Here's the last year's.
This year won't be stopped, listeners.
I know I won't. Because I spent ages doing these stats. I feel like I've got to share them with someone, because otherwise they'll go to waste completely. 6-1, 6-0, 3-1, 4-0.
So what was that?
Sean England,
you
bastards. He'd be loving a call of you.
Right.
I should probably call Sean. I reckon Sean probably rings 0898 numbers where people just talk stats to him.
that's a chilling thought. Listen, Neymar looked pretty special in that game.
Didn't he? I mean, it was one of those games that, I mean, lots of people have talked about him being messy this weekend. I think it was much more like Ronaldinho, actually. It was kind of, you know, I mean, I'm not suggesting that it's not good fun to watch Messi, but Ronaldinho was more fun. It was more kind of entertaining. It was a bit more kind of maddening, a bit more baffling. And Neymar was like that this weekend. He should have won four penalties. Only got two of them, scored two of them. People on, doing nutmegs, running at people, just basically really, really enjoying it. And it was great fun to watch. And it was quite important as well, because in Messi's absence, Barcelona have not been quite as good. And you know, I know we've talked about this before, it's a bit bizarre to moan about injuries when you've still got Neymar and Suarez in the forward line, but they kind of needed big performances from those two. And we've had a couple of big performances from Suarez in terms of goals. I actually think Neymar was very, very good, even when they were beaten in Seville, certainly for the last half an hour or so. And he was fantastic this weekend. But again, it was Rio, and kind of very open games and loads of goals against Rio is just sort of what happens.
All right. Well, next up, as we say, they'll be off playing Abate, who are not a side without their dangers, particularly for a defence like Barcelona's that just cannot keep a clean sheet. Abate beating Roma 3-2 in the last round, going, I think, 3-0 up in the first half hour of that game. And they also claimed their 10th Belarusian title in a row over the weekend. 10 titles in a row. That's remarkable. Sid, let me also ask you about one or two other things. A PSG Real... Is that seen as a major danger for Rafa Benitez?
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah, and it is, because Madrid have had quite a lot of injuries, and we're still not sure which players will make it, whether Sergio Ramos will be fully ready, whether Benzema will make it. Gareth Bale was taken off at half time at the weekend, suspiciously, just in time to go and watch Wales play rugby. But that the idea there was that off the back of two international games, when he played 90 minutes, having come from an injury, that they wanted to try and protect him. So I assume at least that he's going to be fit. But there are some doubts, because actually Madrid haven't played particularly well either. They've got the best defensive record in La Liga. They're one of only four teams in Europe not to have been beaten yet. And one of the other ones is also in La Liga, Celta de Vigo, who they play at the weekend. And I just don't think they've been very good so far around Madrid. And there is a sense that, okay, this is kind of a proper test for them.
Right. PSG haven't been beaten yet either.
Well, I think it's PSG, Bayern, Celta and Real Madrid.
Mm. Right. Celta, who are level with Real Madrid and Barcelona at the top of the Liga, after their 2-1 win with another of the teams at the top, Villarreal. So they're taking on Real Madrid this weekend, are they? Ooh.
Yeah. And also they're only behind Real Madrid on overall goal difference. And of course, that's sort of irrelevant, because at the end of the season, it's not overall goal difference that counts, it's head-to-head goal difference.
All right, Sid, I want to ask you about David Moyes, but before we move any further, Celta Vigo being up there, what's the sustainability of that, and what's the wow factor of seeing them there level on points with the big two?
Well, the wow factor is, I mean, to try and put this into context for you, the top of the table at the moment, as you've said, is Real Madrid and Celta and Barcelona. There hasn't been a worse team at the top of the table in terms of points at this stage for over a decade, which of course is a good thing. I mean, it's presented as a bad thing. It's a good thing. It shows that teams are dropping points, that it's quite competitive. Celta, will they keep it up there? They're a Bielsa team. Burrito, the manager, is very much a Bielsa disciple. They're extremely intense. They try and kind of turn the match into a series of one-on-one battles all over the pitch. Whether or not they can keep that energy up all season, I think is a really big question mark. Also, there is a risk of them losing Nolito, who's their best player, to Barcelona in the winter transfer window. He has said that he doesn't want to go anywhere unless it's Barcelona, which of course is a funny sort of way of saying, let me go to Barcelona.
Mm, yeah. Speaking of people being let go, David Moyes Another defeat this weekend for Real Sociedad. A lot of rumours about him maybe turning up at Villa, swapping one Villa for another, if you consider the Spanish lifestyle, of course.
Well, funnily enough, you should say that, from one Villa to another. Last week, at last, he moved out of the hotel he was in and moved into a flat, in the centre of San Sebastian. So it would be a funny time to go now. He was asked after the game whether he was planning to leave, and he said no. I have no intention of going to Aston Villa. I want to stay here at Real Sociedad. Now, of course, there's a chance that decision won't be his, because the pressure is building, and there was quite a lot of whistling at the weekend. And I saw a story somewhere saying that the fans were chanting for him to go, and chanting in English to make sure he understood. And I'm a bit baffled by this, because I've seen a couple of other places saying this isn't true. So I couldn't hear it on the television. I wasn't in the stadium. So I'm trying to get to the bottom of that, because it's a slightly bizarre one. But there's no doubt he's under pressure. And my very strong sensation with this is that he has the important backing of the president, who was a guy who wanted him in the first place, and of course wants to, you know, as the Spanish phrase always has it, has made a big bet and wants to, you know, kind of support that bet and not let himself lose it. But there are other people on the board and around the club who are not so convinced.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. From the unusual to the extraordinary, your website stands out when you build it with Squarespace. Their designer templates let you easily create a unique and beautiful website that looks perfect on any device. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Other Champions League games, Juventus taking on Borussia Mönchengladbach, who are enjoying an incredible return to form under their interim, but is he interim? We shall see. New manager Schubert, and that's going to be a really big game there. Juventus, the one place they have been doing consistently well is in the Champions League. Hashtag says, why did Juventus get more money than Barcelona for the Champions League final last year? The answer being that the money you receive from the Champions League is divided by the number of teams from your nation that are taking part. And it was just kind of them and Roma, basically, and Roma dropped out early on. So, yeah. Juve coming fresh from the 0-0 draw in the Derby d'Italia on Sunday night, which is a very enthralling game for all its goallessness. And before you crack any funnies, it was only the second goalless draw this season in Serie A.
No, I saw it.
Ewan Dewar says, who's actually the favourite in Serie A this season? I can't even begin to bloody figure that one out. I know what you mean, Ewan. It's six teams within 3 points of each other at the top. You've got Fiorentina, 1 point ahead of Roma and Inter, who are 1 point ahead of Napoli, Sassuolo and Lazio. Form team right now has to be Napoli, who've beaten Lazio, Milan, Juventus and Fiorentina. Fiorentina coming just Sunday, looking really impressive. The aggregate score in those games against, you know, some of the top sides in Italy, 15 goals scored, just 2 conceded. Napoli, I wonder, could it be their year? Under the unfancied Maurizio Sarri, who Maradona, the last person to win a title at Napoli, said wasn't fit for them.
Isn't that the first job he's ever had in the top flight?
No, he was with Empoli.
Was he? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Sorry. He was a former bank. Well, he used to work for a bank. Mm. Yeah. But then he jacked it all in to be a top manager. Mm. Right. Bayer Leverkusen hosting Roma. That's another exciting game. We're very keen to see who, set piece wise, who's going to come out best, because arguably you've got the two best set piece takers in Europe there. Miralem Pjanic, who scored 10 of his last 21. And Hakan Çalhanoğlu. Right. Also want to mention Nice. If you want to see a fancy goal this week, but indeed most weeks, Nice are the team to go to. They're scoring loads, Barry, Nice. They're climbing their way steadily up the French table. Hatem Ben Arfa has been almost literally on fire for them. He's got 5 goals in his last 3. And he was on the score sheet, clearly from that, when they beat Rennes. On Sunday night. What was the score there? I think it was like 5-2 in the end, that game. But the best goal was from Saeed Benrahma. Massive goal. Go and check that one out. Rennes-Nice. Rennes. 4-1. Finished 4-1. But, you know, could have been 5-2. It's that kind of game. Euro draw, Barry.
Yes, the Irish will have to keep an eye on Mr. Miralem Pjanic and his free kicks.
There you go.
Because we got Bosnia and Herzegovina.
How do you feel about that draw?
I would have preferred Hungary, but from what I've seen, Bosnia weren't particularly good against Wales, even though they beat them 2-0. And yeah, they got some good players, Asmir Begovic in goal, Pjanic, Edin Dzeko.
If he's fit.
Mm.
They'd have 5 wins from their last 6, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Ireland.
I would give us a chance, but and if we don't beat them over two legs, then fair enough, we don't deserve to go.
That seems fair enough. Those other draws, the other matches, as you've probably seen, are Ukraine, Slovenia, Norway, Hungary, and Sweden, Denmark. Liquidator 22 has a fun playoff fact about Sweden, Denmark. When abbreviated, Sweden and Denmark, those two words make Sweden, and the remaining letters make Denmark. It's got to be a first in football, that. Okay. AP Hughes writes in, "Dear Pod, why have Leeds sacked another manager? Discuss." Barry?
They just sacked Hughes via Rossler, yep, because he's only won two games out of the 11 he's been in charge.
Ah.
And their owner, Massimo Cellini, looks like, and he may well have made the appointment by the time this goes out, looks like he's going to appoint the delightful gentleman that is Steve Evans.
Steve Evans.
Formerly of Rotherham, formerly of Boston, serial.
Crawley Town.
Mm-hmm.
The Inland Road. Oh, no.
Convicted fraudster, serial abuser of referees, and not a.
When you go to that press conference and he stares at you intently, that might be the reason why, Barry.
I have had a press conference encounter with him before.
Oh, have you?
Yes.
How did that go?
He was at Crawley and they had a match coming up.
With Man United?
I can't remember.
They had a huge game in the FA Cup against Man United.
Must have been that, yeah. And I was sent along to his pre-match presser.
Ah.
And the one thing I noticed, he was wearing makeup for his pre-match press conference.
Like George Osborne?
Well, he had mascara on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Or does he just have very thick...
No, I think he was... I'm pretty sure he was wearing mascara. And apparently he has form for wearing makeup. And he's perfectly entitled to do that. He's a new romantic, possibly, or something. Crawley were the underdogs in this tie, but nobody wanted them to win because they're not a very popular team. Mm. Or for some reason.
They're regarded as having bought their success, yes, that they were parvenues down in the world of...
I raised this issue with Mr. Evans, you know, how does it feel being an underdog in the cup that no one wants to win? And he took very grave exception to my tone and question. And it was quite rude. But the last time he was at Elland Road, interestingly, he arrived wearing flip-flop shorts and a sombrero.
Indeed.
Because Rotherham, it was their last game of the season, and they just managed to stay up.
Oh, so okay. He was quite literally
going on his holidays.
Yeah, brilliant.
So he's the sixth manager that's been in charge of Leeds since Cellino took over in April 2014. They've been through Brian McDermott, David Hockaday, Darko Milanic, Neil Redfern, Uwe Rosler, and now Steve Evans.
Right. It says in the report, he left Rotherham in unexplained circumstances. Is that a euphemism?
Well, I think the way... I don't know why he left Rotherham, but the way... I mean, he was quite successful at Rotherham. He got back-to-back promotions with them from...
So he knows what he's doing?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far.
He got back-to-back promotions, Barry.
Yeah, well, he got promotions with Boston as well, and then it turned out that it was all done rather dishonestly.
Oh, I see what you mean.
But I'm not suggesting he did anything of the kind of Rotherham, I hasten to add.
Mm.
But I had a look on the Square Ball. It's a Leeds fanzine. I had a look on, I'm pretty sure it was their website, the forum, just before we came in to record, just to see what the reaction was of Leeds fans. And to say it was... to say they were underwhelmed would be quite an understatement.
Right. Well, don't worry, Leeds fans, there'll be another one along in a minute.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, do you know what? We've just got a couple of other things. Seth from above, many thanks for your post about nominative contradeterminism. I fear we won't have time to fully explore that topic because we still want to talk about Saints Leicester and the brilliant Claudio Ranieri's brilliant masterstroke substitutions. Hang on a sec.
Do you want to talk about this or something?
You've got the water.
It's all gone.
His brilliant substitutions, Greg.
He's known as a tinker man. He tinkered brilliantly again. He brought on Mahrez in the second half, who's been, you know, one of the most impressive players in the early games, but he has dropped him recently. In the previous game, I think he dropped him for Jeff Schlupp. Schlupp came on and scored. This time round, Mahrez came on and Nathan Dyer came on and turned the game round. Dyer put in the cross for Vardy's first goal, and it was Mahrez who supplied the pass for the equaliser. And that's Vardy, who scored 9 goals in 9 Premier League games now, and
right,
he's getting better and better.
Vardy is just the 4th Englishman to score in 6 consecutive Premier League appearances this century, after Owen, Beattie and Sturridge. Incredible stat, that. Mm. Sturridge once played 8 games in a row.
Just imagine. Yeah.
Well, anyway, they're amazing, aren't they, Leicester? And Saints, obviously, they scored 2 goals as well. Well done to them. Spurs-Liverpool. Mm. Spurs-Liverpool, just to finish things off.
A game...
Weren't many expectations for this game.
And no, I mean, the fact that all the talk has been about gegenpressing after the game and who ran the furthest tells you a lot about the actual quality
Liverpool
of the game.
Liverpool ran further than
yeah,
Spurs.
Yeah, well, that is something, in that Spurs are known to be the fittest team in the Premier League and Liverpool outran them. I think Klopp's challenge is there's so much wasted energy in the Premier League in terms of pressing. It's a league everybody goes on about, well, everyone does pressing in the Premier League, it's what everyone does, you know, every week, because it's such a fast league. There's so much bad pressing that I think he perhaps needs to refine it at Liverpool and make sure players don't just run around like headless chickens, and in fact you know, close people down when it matters most.
Did you feel they were a little bit headless chicken?
Well, they kind of, I think there was a lot of willingness to show that, you know, this is the new era and...
Yeah. Look at me, boss.
Yeah, and they've got to be careful because you get booked so easily for, you know, missed timing, even just running into someone, let alone putting a tackle in that. You know, it was a reaction from the players, which I think Klopp wanted to see, and he can now work on that. And he's still got players he needs to come back into that team to make the first 11 a better quality one than was out there against Spurs.
Right, there was praise for Simon Mignolet and Mamadou Sakho, their performances. Alec Evans says, no mention of Spurs in any match review so far. Help me, Football Weekly, you're my only hope. Anyone? Spurs?
Well, they failed to build on that win against City, I suppose. They've drawn 3 games since that.
Interesting.
And, you know, and they scored 4 goals, and you would have thought that would have been the catalyst for them to go on from there and show a bit more creativity, spark something in attack, and they didn't look very creative against Liverpool.
Against Liverpool, though, they had lost their previous 5 matches. Mm. So in some ways, this was a good point for them. All right. They're both in Europa League action this week. Spurs taking on Anderlecht, while it'll be Ruben Kazan who provide Jurgen Klopp with his first home game as a Liverpool manager.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you everything I know about Ruben Kazan now.
One final thing from producer Ben. Have the Liverpool fans already coined a song for Jurgen?
No, there's all kind. There's an Electric Avenue
How does that
thing.
Work?
I don't know. I don't know. But there's still, you know, it's still being debated, I think, as to what the, you know, what the lead song is going to be for Klopp.
Good, refreshing honesty, Greg, and there's no place for that in this podcast. So, okay. We're looking forward to those games in the Europa League and, of course, all that Champions League action. If you want, and you're in the UK, you can join me, James Horncastle, Julian Aron, Raphael Honigstein for the goals as they happen on BT Sport Tuesday and Wednesday night. Yeah. But we'll be back anyway to round it all up on Thursday morning for Weekly Extra. In the meantime, many thanks to Barry Glendenning. Greg Bukowski.
Thanks.
And yes, Amy Lawrence.
Cheers.
And producer Ben, go on then. He says thanks. For being here, and have a nice couple of days. Bye-bye for now.
Hello everyone, producer Ben here. Just to let you know, you'll be able to download my new book from Monday the 26th of October. It's called Podcast Master, and it's about the history of podcasts, the future of podcasts, how to start your own podcast, and how to build your audience. That title again, Podcast Master. It's out next Monday.